Sally Sell versus George W. Bush.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Mark Berman, and I represent the petitioner, Ali Al-Mari. This appeal turns on a trilogy of Supreme Court cases that respondents have misconstrued: Ex parte Endo, Abrams versus Clark, and Braden versus 30th Judicial Circuit Court. In Endo, the Supreme Court held that the government cannot defeat habeas jurisdiction by removing the petitioner from the district in which he had filed their habeas petition. The court noted but declined to answer the question of whether the petitioner's presence in the district was required for the district court to exercise habeas jurisdiction in the first instance. In Ahrens, the Supreme Court held that it was not, but the court reversed itself in Braden. In Braden, the Supreme Court held that a district court can exercise habeas jurisdiction regardless of whether the petitioner is present in the district, so long as the court's process can reach the petitioner's custodian. And with respect to venue, the court held that the district court was required to weigh traditional venue considerations to determine whether the venue chosen by the petitioner was an appropriate one. In this case, we filed a habeas petition.
What do you think we should do with our established precedents like Robledo-Gonzalez? I notice you never discuss Robledo-Gonzalez at all, although it involves, so far as I can see, the very same issue that's at stake here.
Well, Robledo-Gonzalez dealt with the question of who the petitioner's custodian was. And that that issue arose in a different context. It arose in the context of an INS detention.
Yeah, and we thought it was exactly the same as criminal. We cited criminal habeas cases interchangeably. That's what we relied on.
And there's a circuit split on that issue, which the Supreme Court eventually has to decide. But for purpose
of
today,
I understand that, but we're on one side of that. Right? I would have expected you to discuss what we should do with our own precedent.
Well, the distinction between this case and Robledo-Gonzalez is that in this case, unlike the Attorney General in immigration matters, where the Attorney General sort of has a supervisory capacity and sits above it all, in this case, in the case of an enemy combatant, the President and the Secretary of Defense have played a very active role in this particular case. That is,
I don't understand what difference that makes. Attorney General is in charge of immigration matters. Parole, probation under the United States, and so on are discretionary decisions of the Attorney General. We held that that did not make him the right custodian. The custodian, we said, was the person with immediate physical custody. Why is that proposition any different here?
And the answer, again, is because of the uniqueness of the role that was played by the President and the Secretary of Defense. That is,
I actually don't understand what the President is doing in this litigation either. It's a pretty established principle that you can't sue the President. And when somebody sues the President, that indicates they're engaged in frivolous litigation.
Well, that's an issue we did address in the briefs, and it's one that the court, of course, can choose not to address, because the other courts who have been confronted with enemy combatant litigation have opted not to address, because, of course, Mr. Al-Mari and the other enemy combatants have been, by order of the President, have been transferred to the custody of the Secretary of Defense.
But look, I don't understand why that kind of thing matters. An ordinary state prisoner is in prison by order of a judge. But you don't sue the judge to seek a writ of habeas corpus. The person who ordered the custody is not the right respondent. It's the custodian who's the right respondent.
Right, and the reason for that is that once the judge has sentenced the defendant, his role in the matter has come to an end.
Yes, and then he can be released by the governor, but you don't sue the governor either to seek a writ of habeas corpus.
Right, but the governor hasn't played a role in the case up until that point, and doesn't play a role until an application for a pardon is made. In this case, the President and the Secretary of Defense have in fact played a role, and a very direct role, in the events that gave rise to Mr. Al-Mari's confinement.
Can you clear up the timing here? When was the petition for a writ of habeas corpus filed in relation to his transfer to South Carolina?
It was filed on June 23rd, we made an application with Judge Mim for leave to file the habeas petition right then, because recall on that morning.
Was that the day that the case, the criminal charges were dismissed?
Yes, right then, as the criminal charges were being dismissed.
We looked in the record, by the way, and can't find any such application. We can find an application for a TRO to prevent the transfer, but we could not find an application for leave to file a petition, nor, for that matter, do I even understand what such a thing would be. You just file motions. You don't file applications for leave to file motions.
Well, that has to be put in context. On the morning of...
No. Either you filed it or you didn't. Is the docket of the district court correct or is it not correct?
Mr. Smith made an application, an oral application, to Judge Mim to file a habeas petition. And
so why does the district court record not show any such application?
I presume because it was an oral application and because at that point Judge Mim's view was that the case had come to a close and he didn't have jurisdiction to entertain that application. But in any event,
he couldn't show that he accepted it and denied it.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear Your Honor.
He couldn't show that he accepted it and denied it.
It was.
Wouldn't that be the proper way to do it? Did you ask him to do that?
Mr. Smith, we did not ask him to do that, but nevertheless, it was Judge Mim's view that he didn't have the authority to do it.
Is there any order of the district court that's entered in response to this thing that we can't find in the record?
No, the answer is no. And
so there's no application in the record, there's no order in the record. Appellate courts decide things on the basis of records.
The court can characterize the transcript as it sees fit, obviously. I believe that Mr. Smith's words to Judge Mim constituted his application.
In other words, he didn't attempt to file it. That's what you're telling us.
Well, again,
that's a very clever way of saying it.
He didn't file something in writing because on that morning he wasn't aware why he was being summoned to Judge Mim.
That's a very clever way of saying it. It's very creative.
Well, again, it goes back to the circumstances.
Why didn't you just tell us he didn't file anything?
He didn't file something in writing, but he made an oral application.
That's why we couldn't find it.
There's a difference between filing something and making an oral motion. When you say in your brief, so-and-so filed something, you mean he did those acts that lawyers talk about as filing something. And that leads us to look for something, and there's nothing there. But if we're going to use words in a Humpty Dumpty way, we're not going to get very far.
Well, I apologize if that was what the court endeavored to do. What was intended was
that's
the fact
that's what your brief says over and over. You filed something, and nothing was filed.
Mr. Smith,
we now agree.
Mr. Smith made an oral application, and that constituted, as the way we characterize it, the filing of the motion, the application to file a writ of habeas corpus. And again,
is there any such thing in federal practice as a request for leave to file a petition for habeas corpus? I don't understand the concept, I will confess.
Well, again, I think it has to be viewed in the context in which these events arose, which is that on the morning of the 23rd, Mr. Smith was summoned to Judge Mim's chambers without any notice of what works to conspire.
I'm just asking whether there is such a thing. The norm in federal practice, it's actually provided in the rules, is that if you want some relief, you request it. You may file a motion. It's conceivable you may request the relief orally. But I don't understand the concept of motions for leave to request or motions for leave to file. It doesn't seem to me an extant thing in federal practice.
There is no particular rule that provides that one can file a motion for leave to file a habeas petition, but the habeas statute itself requires that the habeas petition be in writing. And since Mr. Smith was surprised on the morning of June 23rd, wasn't given notice as to why he was to attend, it was impossible to have a writing with him because he didn't know what the purpose of the hearing was for. So under those circumstances, he asked for leave to file the writing that's required by Section 2241, which I think is an appropriate way to respond given the circumstances. And those circumstances are that no notice was given to us, even though we had been in litigation with the government for all these months, that on the morning of the 23rd, Mr. Almari was going to be whisked out of the Central District of Illinois. Had we been given notice, certainly we would have had a written document, which is required by the rules, but under the circumstances, that was impossible. And therefore, the oral application was made. And again, Judge Mim held that he didn't have authority to entertain it because the criminal matter had been dismissed with prejudice. The issue of who is the custodian really goes to the core of Judge Mim's venue determination, even though that really isn't relevant to venue, it's relevant to jurisdiction. And to turn back to where I had left off, in Ex parte Endo, the Supreme Court noted but declined to answer the question of whether the petitioner's presence within the district was required, held that it was, but in Braden, the Supreme Court held that, in fact, the petitioner's presence wasn't required so long as the custodian can be reached. And so long as Secretary Rumsfeld and or President Bush are appropriate respondents, or if Commander Moore can be reached in the Central District of Illinois, then that petition was properly filed there. And in fact, the petitioners concede that if Mr. Smith had given notice and thus could have had a written petition on that morning, that it would fall under the rule of Endo itself, and that the court in the Central District of Illinois would be an appropriate jurisdiction and venue for the habeas petition. So what it comes down to is that the respondents are asking the court to adopt a rule in which they can dictate which forum habeas petitions are filed in and which...
Yeah, it happens all the time. State houses somebody in a prison in the Northern District of Illinois, it means you can't go before Judge Mim. State picks him up and moves him to Carbondale, it means you can't go before Judge Kokoris here in the Northern District. It's a daily event in the handling of prisoners. And of course, in the federal system, where the prison system is nationwide, people get taken from Illinois and put in Latuna.
The difference is that under 2241, the type of habeas petition that a federal convict is filing is attacking the execution of a sentence, which obviously is being sentences exist in the place where he's confined, and again, that's where the only custodian is located. So not so much as a matter of venue, but as a matter of jurisdiction, that's the only district which has authority.
But I just don't understand what's wrong with the idea that the people are moved from district to district, as long as there is a district, one, where one can bring the proceeding. What's the problem?
And the answer is that Braden holds to the contrary. What Braden holds is that if there are in cases in which there's more than one person who's a custodian, that's...
Yes, in Braden there were two sentences at issue from different states. And one can be in custody on two sentences simultaneously, the Supreme Court held. One might think that's a special case, but my practical question is, you were trying to say there's something wrong or terrible about the fact that the United States can transfer a person to a prison in South Carolina as opposed to Illinois, and I'm asking, why is that a problem so long as you always have access to the court where the custodian is located?
And the answer is that typical 2241 isn't challenging events that transpired in a different venue. In cases where the 2241 does challenge events that took place in a different venue, like Braden, the court has held that venue is appropriate in the venue where the material events took place, regardless...
I still don't understand. It is possible to bring 2241 petitions when 2255 is inadequate. That's paragraph 5 of 2255. You've got a convicted federal prisoner. People who are convicted in Illinois may be housed anywhere in the United States and sometimes outside. Sometimes they're returned by treaty to foreign nations. So they may go anywhere. Your proposition is that the 2241 for such a prisoner would be brought in the sentence in the district where the person was convicted. And that would, you know, in addition to upsetting 200 years worth of law, make not very much sense. Why is it not enough that the person who is convicted in Illinois and sent to Latuna can't bring his 2241 in the Southern District of Texas?
That, under 2255, if that person...
You're in your last minute.
I'll just respond to the one question and I'll take it away.
Mm-hmm.
If that prisoner is challenging the substance of his conviction under 2255, he challenges it in the case where the conviction was imposed. It's only if he's challenging the execution of his sentence that he's then in the district where he's confined. And Braden itself stands for that proposition because the petitioner in Braden was challenging the denial of his right to a speedy trial in Kentucky And the court held that that was properly venued in Kentucky, even though he was confined in Alabama. That is, even though his immediate custodian was in Alabama, the custodian that mattered was in Kentucky, because that's where the material events took place. That custodian was subject to the process of the court in Kentucky, and for that reason, it was an appropriate venue for that habeas petition. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. This case has its origins in the events of September 11th and the President's efforts to respond to those attacks and prevent future attacks. Although the war on terrorism raises a number of novel and difficult legal issues, with all respect, the case before you today is not one of them. The District Court below applied settled law to the specific circumstances of this case and concluded that the proper place for a petitioner to challenge the current situation and illegality of the detention is in the place of the detention, such that the proper place to file a petition challenging the legality of petitioner's detention in South Carolina is in the District Court for South Carolina.
What if the habeas was now filed in South Carolina, and then while it's pending, the government moves into Alaska?
Well, Your Honor, in that situation, you would have a different question, and I think then you'd be within the Endo decision at that point. And I think what the Endo decision suggests is at that point the petition could take place in South Carolina and also could be filed in Alaska. And indeed, there's a decision of this court, Roth against Membane, which is actually cited in petitioner's brief at page 48, which suggests that even in that situation, there's often a preference as a matter of venue principles for having the case proceed in the place of confinement. Now, certainly at some point, if the United States or whoever the custodian was moved a prisoner several times, I think at some point the courts would say, all right, enough already, the case is going to proceed in one district rather than another. But I think it's important that this circuit has recognized that in the normal case, even if you're in an endo situation, absent, I think the court said, unusual situations or other considerations, the case would still best be considered in the place of confinement. But as I think it's important to recognize, that is a very different case. That would put this case, your hypothetical would put this case in the reach of the Supreme Court's decision in Endo. And with respect, I don't think the record in this case suggests that this case is within the confines of the Endo case. And the reason I say that, as some of the questions from Your Honors alluded to, is if you look at the record, what happened, as best I can tell from the written record of what happened below, is not that there was a leave to file a petition for habeas, even if such a motion exists, but rather, if you look at pages A30 through A33 of the appendix to petitioner's brief, it has the transcript of the proceedings of the morning of June 23rd, 2003. And I wasn't at that hearing, but my reading of that transcript makes clear that what petitioner's counsel was attempting to do was not to seek leave to file a petition for habeas, but rather to get a stay of the dismissal with prejudice. I think if you read those pages in context, I think the concern the petitioner's counsel had was that the individual would be moved outside the United States, such that there would be no place to file a habeas petition.
I asked Mr. Berman about the timing here, and as best I can determine, he was moved to South Carolina before anything was filed in our common understanding of filing in this district.
That's exactly right, Your Honor. I think it was about 2 weeks.
We have a different case if he was here and the petition for writ of habeas corpus was filed here. He declared an enemy combatant and held here. The habeas is filed, and then he's moved to South Carolina. Would we have a different situation?
We would have a different case, Your Honor. I think I would still be up, I might well still be up here arguing on the authority of this Ross against Membane case that the proper place to proceed is still the South Carolina, but I would not have this court's Middlestead decision as authority. I wouldn't have this court's Mickelin decision as authority. I wouldn't have Robledo Gonzalez as authority. So I'd be in a much weaker legal position.
But you say that once if this person has moved to various different places, there'd come a time where you would have multiple forms that you could file.
I think that's right, and I think, again, I think once the government moves a petitioner after a petition has been filed, I think there are two possible jurisdictions, and then I think that traditional factors of venue the court would be required to apply those principles and determine, in your hypothetical, whether South Carolina or Alaska is the proper forum for the case to go forward. In this case, however, we think both principles of jurisdiction and this court's cases dealing with venue, and those are the cases I just referred to, Middlestead, Nicolone, and Robledo Gonzalez, all suggest that the one forum where this case is properly filed is the District for South Carolina and not the Central District of Illinois. One other point I'd just like to clarify in terms of one thing that came up during appellant's argument is that this idea of naming the president as a respondent, the petitioner's counsel suggested that the other courts that have looked at this have just ignored that fact. That's actually not entirely accurate. The district court in the Padilla case, for example, specifically focused on that question, engaged in a colloquy with counsel much like that between Judge Easterbrook and counsel here this morning, and then struck the president as a respondent, because I think it's clear from a variety of cases, but most particularly from Franklin against Massachusetts, that this petition should not have named the president as a respondent, as a matter of principles having nothing really to do specifically with habeas. Now, with respect to habeas-specific principles, it seems equally clear that Secretary Rumsfeld is not a proper respondent, that the proper respondent here is Commander Maher of the facility in South Carolina. The petitioner and Commander Maher are both present in the District of South Carolina. And that explains why Judge Mim was able to conclude, both as a matter of settled law in this circuit, that the case belonged in South Carolina, but also, in an abundance of caution, the judge put those principles to one side, applied traditional venue factors, and still found that the case belonged in South Carolina, because the proper petitioner and the proper respondent are both located there. Judge Mim went through the various prayers for relief in the habeas petition, and he noted that those prayers for relief all go to the district in South Carolina. I mean, for one thing, the object of a writ of habeas corpus is to seek a prisoner's release from custody. That would be effectuated in South Carolina. The various concerns about the extent to which counsel has access, whether or not the petitioner has access to consular officials, the International Committee for Red Cross, those issues all go to the conditions of confinement in South Carolina and are properly addressed in the South Carolina court. And again, that is consistent with the established law of this court. Last point I'll mention just in passing is that petitioners also challenge and complain that Judge Mim reversed the normal order of proceeding by considering venue before considering jurisdiction, and that indeed he conflated the two concepts. That is clearly wrong. I think in the first place, the district court clearly understood the difference between venue and jurisdiction and made clear that it was ruling as a matter of venue. That is a permissible way of proceeding.
Is the reference in 2241 to within their jurisdictions a matter of either venue or personal jurisdiction, as you understand it?
I think after the Supreme Court's Braden decision, it is probably best understood as a matter of personal jurisdiction. Now, I think, though, that in Braden-type situations where you have two custodies and therefore two potential respondents, in endo situations where the prisoner is moved, there are two available forums, you also have considerations of venue that are distinct from personal jurisdiction. As I understood what the district court did in this case, is it recognized that the questions about jurisdiction, although relatively straightforward in this circuit, do raise some difficult questions on which the courts of appeals have divided. Whereas
I thought your position was that decisions like Wales and Carbo had treated that as not having to do with either venue or personal jurisdiction or, for that matter, subject jurisdiction, but simply saying that it referred to the district court's territorial coverage. And cases like Braden, the district court is issuing the writ within its territory because it finds a proper custodian within its territory.
Right. I mean, I think ultimately that's our position. I guess I thought your earlier question was directed to a slightly different matter. I think when push comes to shove, our position would be that within their respective jurisdictions really embodies a particularized view of territorial jurisdiction such that the writ is really limited to individuals within the territory of the district court. And I think that
just turns out to be a very unusual, at least to modern ears, use of the word jurisdiction.
I think that's right, Your Honor.
It's an old statute.
It is an old statute, and if you look at the history of the statute that was reflected in the Carbo decision, for example, it's clear that the concern that Congress was addressing with that language was precisely the concern that judges in district courts far distant from where the petitioner was being confined would issue orders for the prisoner's release or for the prisoner's appearance. And so I think that that is clearly reflects our position, but I think the district court recognizing that, as you put it, Judge Easterbrook, that statutory concept is unusual to the modern ear and that different courts have resolved that question differently, sees on the venue concept as being a way of deciding the case that was the narrowest available ground to decide the case, because even if you accepted that after Braden these principles were not strictly ones of personal jurisdiction or the like, that you could still hold in a case like this where the individual challenges the present physical confinement, that case clearly belongs in the district of confinement. I think that much of the Supreme Court precedent in this trilogy of cases that Petitioner Counsel has referred to, and also in the Straight against Laird case that the Supreme Court decided, were all targeted to very unusual situations. The Braden situation, where you have two districts with potential claims on the individual, two forms of custody at issue. Straight against Laird, where the court had sort of expanded the concept of custody to involve an individual who wasn't physically in prison, was at liberty, but had a sort of more metaphysical custody because of his situation vis-a-vis the military, and suggested in that concept, too, there might be a more relaxed notion. But I think you look in vain in these Supreme Court cases for any indication that in the classic situation, where you have an individual who is challenging the legality of his present physical confinement, that case should be brought anywhere but in the current district of confinement. And I think that in the sense that the Supreme Court cases dealing with unusual situations provide no support for this very classic use of the writ. As I think the district court recognized, there are many aspects about this case that are unusual, but it is actually, for purposes of the habeas statute, quite a usual case. It is a classic use of the writ to challenge the petitioner's present physical confinement. If there are no further questions, we'd submit on the briefs and ask the court to affirm. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. The court will take the case under advisement.